Born of Haitian descent, Jerry Paris, WPFW's general manager, is moving on to retirement. On April 14th, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m., we will celebrate his departure at the VIP Room, 6201 3rd Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., with island flair, steel drums, a DJ, and food from the islands. That's April 14th from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m. For more information and tickets, call 202-368-4081 or visit Eventbrite and search for Jerry Paris Retirement. Seating is limited.
Y'all, this is Rod Stars.
This is G1. Together we Rebel Diaz.
And when we out here in D.C., the DMV, we bump WPFW.
Washington.
Every Tuesday, 9 to 10 a.m., Voices with Vision. You heard? Understand. We've been trying to move this struggle from a lower to a higher level.
This is Voices with Vision, bringing you news and analysis.
It's about cutting-edge social justice issues by mixing various voices and ideas
with information, cultural expressions, and commentary.
Voices with Vision airs every Tuesday on your jazz and justice station, WPFW.
Good morning. It's the Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024 edition of Voices with Vision, the show that's not for the politically faint of heart. I'm one of your co-hosts, Netflix Freeman, in the virtual studio with your other co-host, Brother Craig. Today is Black Agenda Report Day on Voices with Vision. Right, Brother Craig?
That's right. Good morning, Netflix, and good morning to all of our listeners and podcast subscribers. On today's show, we speak with Mark Fancher about his Black Agenda Report article, Black, Angry, and Proud of It. And then Dr. Wilmer Leon about his Black Agenda Report article, It's Not Voter Apathy, You're Not Listening.
And we start everything off with the column-turned audio commentary from Bar Executive Editor Margaret Kimberly, The People's Ceasefire, for Mumia Abu-Jamal, Leonard Peltier, and all U.S.-held political prisoners languishing behind prison walls. What's the call?
Freedom all.
The People's Ceasefire. The Biden administration deserves no praise for abstaining from a United Nations Security Council resolution which demands that Israel observe a two-week-long ceasefire in Gaza. The U.S. vetoed numerous resolutions already and was forced into doing the barest of minimums because of domestic and international political pressure. In recent weeks, Joe Biden made an odd and obviously staged public statement on the floor of Congress, claiming to have been angry with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, leaked stories to the media, made the same assertion that Biden referred to Netanyahu as, quote unquote, a butthole, even as he continued to pour military aid into Israel. Political leaders like Senator Chuck Schumer made a great show of criticizing Netanyahu in a stage-managed good cop and bad cop routine. The thanks for this brief respite from the killing spree goes to ordinary people who took to the streets in mass protests, demanding that the carnage come to an end. Here in the United States, the abandoned Biden campaign made clear that voters would express their displeasure by defeating Biden's re-election effort. And yet, the determination to continue supporting Israel is clear. No sooner had the resolution passed than the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, called the vote non-binding when there is no such thing as a non-binding UN resolution. Even after being forced into accepting a 2-week ceasefire, the Biden administration makes clear that it will support Israel's war crimes, regardless of UN votes, the wishes of other nations. There was already a ceasefire in November 2023. The hostages who Israel claims to care so much about began to be returned, and the people of Gaza were safer for a short time. But Israel was determined to continue its campaign of ethnic cleansing. Even the International Court of Justice ruling, calling South Africa's charge of genocide plausible and which required Israel to stop killing Palestinians, didn't stop the bloodshed. As the ceasefire resolution passed, Israel was killing patients and medical professionals at the Al-Shifa Hospital. Israeli settlers and officials have engaged in a sustained campaign to stop aid trucks from entering Gaza. Universities have been destroyed. There are, in fact, no universities left in Gaza. A recently released video shows a drone strike killing 4 Gaza men. The atrocities never ended, and they could not have been carried out absent United States political and financial support. This ceasefire, such as it is, would not have happened if the people had not remained in motion, opposing U.S. and Israeli genocide as much as they could. But caution is called for. Turncoats and false friends like Senator Bernie Sanders and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez now use the words genocide and ceasefire when they had previously refused to do so. They are still false friends. Both Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez are committed Biden supporters, but they know which way the political winds are blowing. They can no longer manage what they consider to be an inconvenient public relations problem. The activism on behalf of the people of Gaza created a political crisis, which is as it should be. There is never positive change unless the powers that be can see that they and the system they protect face some degree of risk. This ceasefire resolution came about only because the people demanded it. Any credit given must go to unnamed people who have made their outrage clear and who have acted upon it. The pressure must be sustained. If it is not, Biden and his partners in crime in the Congress and in the corporate media will behave as though all is well. They want to believe they have a marketing problem that can be resolved with enough focus group wordsmithing instead of a political movement that cannot be stopped. Fortunately, the protest continues. The New York presidential primary will be held on April 2nd, but New York does not have provisions for uncommitted choices as other states do. Instead, the demand must be made with a blank ballot. The Leave It Blank campaign asks New Yorkers to return blank ballots, which nonetheless will be counted. The worst outcome would be if Biden and his cohorts concluded that they could return to the status quo and continue to support Israel without fear of opposition. Actually, that has already happened, as the Biden administration bypassed Congress to send $250 million in military aid to Israel. It is painful to watch as money and brute force are used to cover up Israel's and America's crimes and silence those who point them out. Every success, no matter how small, must be acknowledged. That is why this ceasefire should be called the People's Ceasefire. The people of the Republic of South Africa charged Israel with genocide when no other country would. People across this country refused to vote for Joe Biden and openly called for his defeat. The solidarity from people in the streets and from Black religious leaders who conveyed the outrage and the concern of their congregants, and even the few politicians willing to speak up, are all the successes in this story. And yet, the devils are busy. The 75-year history of U.S. support for Israel will not disappear. There can be no confusion that criticism of Netanyahu is at all meaningful while support for the Zionist project continues. The fight must go on. Only the people, acting in concert and with determination, can bring these crimes to an end.
For Africans in the U.S., navigating the upper echelons of the system means treading lightly and avoiding speaking inconvenient truths to power, and especially not with any hint of passion or anger. But for Africans in the U.S., anger is an important first step in mentally emancipating ourselves from the empire and declaring war on it. To unpack this political and even geopolitical conundrum, we will unpack or look at the article entitled Black, Angry, and Proud of It, published in the latest issue of Black Agenda Report. With us is the author of the article, our brother Mark Fancher. Mark Fancher is a human rights attorney, writer, activist, and martial artist. His legal work addresses abuse of police practices, racial profiling, racial discrimination in public employment, mass water shutoffs, racial harassment of students, use of indigenous peoples' imagery and names as brands and mascots, and other matters affecting communities of color. His commentaries and analysis about military intervention in Africa and other underdeveloped regions, domestic police violence, the criminal justice system, political repression, ongoing global campaigns for the independence and self-determination of Africa and Africa's diaspora, theology, and various issues related to racial justice have appeared in Black Agenda Report, Yes Magazine, LA Progressive, and numerous other commercial and academic publications. Fancher's life and perspectives are guided by his Christian faith. Brother Mark Fancher, welcome back to Voices with Vision. I'd like to brag that this is not your first time.
Oh, no. It's my honor, and I thank you for the opportunity to come back and to share ideas with you.
Mm-hmm. So this is a great article, as I said to you in an email, had to get you in here to unpack this. So let's go with it. So despite the absence of the academic studies on this phenomenon of Black people, you know, the stereotype of the angry Black person and whatnot, and how that impacts how we, like I said, navigate the system, Black people, we're aware of it. We've been aware of it for a long time. So contextualize this for others who may not get it. And also, you know, for me, may not even recognize what we're talking about.
Yes, I think that there are many of us who understand intuitively, if not explicitly and consciously, that when we are in the presence of white people with power, that we have to be very careful to moderate our conduct and our speech, our mannerisms, so that we don't cause them to feel threatened. And they seem to become very threatened very easily. And it's not just something that we have to speculate about. I think there are so many of us, if not all of us, at one time or another, have been told directly by white people that, you know, you sound angry. And it comes as sort of a shock, because that's not necessarily what's going on in our heads. We may be passionate about a point. We may have become slightly animated physically because we want to emphasize something, but anger is not part of the equation, but that's the reaction and the response that we get.
And can I just jump real quick? Sometime I think we aren't even sounding angry or anything. It's just like, you know, how they don't want to deal with what we have, where we're saying, or the situation. Anyway, that's my
Oh, yeah. It's part of a broader kind of effort that's made to, as you say, shut down discussion of things that cause them to be uncomfortable. One of the most effective devices that they developed was the phrase, the race card, so that anytime that you start to make a comment, you know, an informed and important analysis of race or to say anything, then they can shut that down quickly by saying, well, there you go, playing the race card. And it causes people to just quiet down and to shut down and to stop all discussion of what should be the focal point of discussion and exchange. But I think that all of it's tragic, but the most tragic aspect of it, I think, is the way in which so many of us begin to police ourselves. We put our own constraints on our own behavior and our own speech because we don't want to prompt any type of a reaction that's going to cause them to say that we're threatening or that we're angry or any of those kinds of things. And that's really sort of the background of it. And it's particularly a phenomenon in corporate circles, in government circles. That's where it comes up the most. And, you know, sometimes if you see African people in those arenas, it looks like they're walking around with shoes that are on way too tight. I mean, you can just sense how tense they are, how uptight they are, because they're trying not to make a misstep. They're trying not to say something that's going to cause them some type of a problem.
Mm. Can I read one passage from the article and also ask you if you want have an additional comment? Because you also indicate in the article that the issue can be compounded when we consider sexism and patriarchy in a system. And one of the, where is it? It's a quote that you have. This commentator, Savala Nolan, said, quote, "I, like many Black women, carefully monitor my expressions and body language to make sure I sound calm and reasonable, calibrating myself into a narrow register designed not to scare or offend people in power. It's exhausting. It's dehumanizing. It cuts into my sense of worth and well-being. I can't say for sure that it contributes to my anxiety, something I've lived with since I was a teenager. But anxiety is, in part, a feeling of unease or uncertainty about how things will go, a sense that you aren't totally safe. And the angry Black woman caricature puts endless pressure on me to perform niceness in order to stay normally safe and likable in a world that doesn't particularly like or protect Black women and girls. How could this not feed my chronic sense of uncertainty and unease?" End quote.
Yeah, I mean, the stereotype of the angry Black woman is pervasive, and it's so well known and established that it has even found its way into caricatures, which I think is really phenomenal that you can caricature a stereotype. But, you know, Aunt Esther in Sanford and Son, you know, causes many to believe that, you know, any Black woman who becomes upset or angry might just swing her purse at them, or, you know, the neck rock and the finger wag and all of the things that are associated with the stereotype of the so-called angry Black woman. And this goes back many generations. It's nothing unusual. There is also the angry Black man stereotype, but it's of a different quality and a different character in some respects. The angry Black woman on some level is regarded as somebody who is maybe somewhat threatening, but there is no real fear of the angry Black woman. She's almost sort of a comic caricature, one that's annoying, one that can get in the way. The angry Black man is regarded as a true threat that has to be snuffed out. There is no room for laughing at the angry Black man. That man must be killed with no hesitation. So both of these are incredibly destructive, not just physically, but psychically. And they are continuing problems that plague our community on a lot of levels. And unfortunately, there are many who don't even regard it as a problem. They think that it's just part of what's necessary to navigate your way successfully through life. And that's really what my article is focused on, the fact that it's not necessary.
Yeah, Mark, you write that if a person is highly stressed, by the challenges of avoiding the angry black person tag, it is evidence of that person's perceptions that they have a stake in the system. I'm understanding from your article that what you're saying is, you know, African people suppressing their anger is like a symptom of an integrationist mentality, the idea that white supremacy should be appeased, that our objective should be to secure a place in the system. What do you think will move people in the direction of fighting against the system, you know, racism, capitalism, imperialism? And what can those of us who are a voice of anger and who do act against the system, what can we do to accelerate the movement?
A big part of the tragedy is that it's not always a case where those who believe that, they believe that they have a stake in the system and that they believe that they have to integrate into it, that they have to elevate themselves and ascend through it. It's not always their belief that it should be this way. They resent it and they wish that it wasn't this way, but they have come to conclude that it is the only way and they don't enjoy it at all. There are some Negroes who do enjoy it and who very much would love to be white. But there are many who really don't want to be a part of it, but they feel like they have no alternative. It's a matter of survival. And I think that it has not always been that way. Certainly, if we go back to the earliest years of the African presence in the United States, there were, among those who were enslaved, among many of them, a belief that this system, you know, certainly the slave system, had no place for them really, other than to exploit and oppress them. They had no interest or desire to become a part of it. They only wanted to destroy it. And in fact, their perception was that their survival depended upon its destruction, not their integration into it, not their becoming a part of it, but destroying it. And so for people like that, the last thing in the world that they're concerned about is whether the people who are the masters of the slave economy, you know, the slave system, whether they're going to be perceive them as being angry. You know, they darn well better know they're angry and that they're coming after them. First opportunity, they're going to slit their throats. You know, they're going to burn their crops. They're going to burn down the big house. They're going to bust up the farm equipment. They're going to do whatever they got to do in order to bring down this system. And you say, I'm angry. Yes, I am. And I'm coming after you. So they never had this stress or this worry because they didn't feel like they were a part of that. And to a certain extent, even in the years after that, during Reconstruction and during the long period of Jim Crow, when we were living essentially in a segregated sort of a condition, there was an understanding that we were oppressed and we were surrounded by hostility and hostile forces. And you did have to demonstrate subservience in certain situations when you came into contact with white society so that you wouldn't get lynched. But at the same time, it was during these periods that we saw the rise of movements and leaders who were not at all shy about expressing their hostility to an oppressive system, you know, Marcus Garvey just being one of them. So I think that that's the dilemma that we face now, is that we feel like there's really no other place to go, that if we're going to prosper, if our families are going to prosper, we better learn to get along and we better learn how to navigate the corporate world, government world, you know, the private sector, wherever it is that we're going to try and find jobs and employment. That's what we got to learn how to do. And part of that means that you can't come off as being angry. And the point that I'm making in the article is that it's really just a crisis of misperception. And I specifically point to an analysis that was done by Huey Newton, who was one of the co-founders of the Black Panther Party, who saw very clearly, years before many other people did, that that's not really what's going on in the world. That while there are many now who believe that the community that they belong to is the United States of America, that they're part, that they're discriminated against in this country, that Africans are not given a fair shake, that they're abused by police and other things, but that the United States really wants to embrace them. They're just having trouble doing it. That our first allegiance is to the United States of America, and that we just need to do what we need to do in order to become a part of it. You know, whether that's registering to vote and voting, getting good jobs, you know, helping white people to understand that we are just like they are, all that kind of thing. We still think that our community is the United States of America. And that's who's going to ultimately protect us. And that's a total misperception of what's happening. What Huey Newton explained is that that United States of America is a myth, that it doesn't exist, that there is a community that uses the brand United States of America, but it is really an empire that's dominated and controlled by powerful corporations, by wealthy individuals and families, and other members of an oligarchy. And that they really, their purpose is not to create or to maintain a single United States of America that embraces all of its people and treats them fairly and gives them a democracy to live and thrive in. Their objective is to manipulate and exploit all of the people of all colors in the United States of America, that's their job. And it's for the purpose of consolidating and expanding their own power and their own wealth. And so that little community is poised to attack, manipulate, exploit, and oppress all other communities around the world. That there's this one empire that interacts with others that with a shared interest or in other countries and other parts of the world. It's this elite group of people and corporations.
The 1%.
Yes, exactly. That dominate the entire planet. And they know no borders. They know no national boundaries. They're global in their efforts to oppress and exploit and to expand their empire through imperialist practices. So what Huey Newton said is that all of the rest of us are part of other communities. In the United States, we're part of a community of oppressed and exploited people. And Africa has its communities. The Caribbean has its communities. There are exploited people everywhere. And what he said is that all of those communities should come together in what he called revolutionary intercommunalism. And they should focus all of their coordinated efforts to attack and respond to reactionary intercommunalists, these imperialist powerful people who dominate and exploit everybody else. And once you have that understanding that that's your community, then you don't worry about angering the more powerful people.
Yeah, and a quick question here, because I know, you know, time is running. You also point out in your article that Martin Luther King made a shift from integration to standing against Wall Street, the military-industrial complex, and the political establishment, and that by doing that, he was marked worthy of death by the government. So how do we, you know, protect ourselves and defend ourselves and our people once we do stand up against the system?
Well, I think that his analysis was dead on, but what he had not have time to do, and maybe not even time enough to analyze and understand, is that the idea of single individuals as leaders is a very dangerous thing to do. Whenever anybody is perceived as the quote unquote Messiah, it's very easy to take them out and destroy the entire movement that's behind them. So the famous Messiah memo put together by the FBI, which, you know, uses that analysis to identify specific people who might become messiahs, is something that informs us and lets us know that really the best defense against that is not to have messiahs, but to have organizations that are established and which function on a mass level, so that everybody develops at the same rate and the same level, and that you take out one or two people, it doesn't stop anything, because everybody knows everything that everybody else knows. They're coordinated and they're organized and they're structured in a way that the movement, the revolution, continues to roll forward no matter what. That's certainly the thinking behind one of the organizations that I work with, the All African People's Revolutionary Party.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you real quick. So one of the things you point out before I ask you this question, and one of the things you point out also that Dr. King says, when you mention people who are trying to accommodate, you know, white power by treading lightly, that they're thinking they have a stake in the system or investment in the system. And then Dr. King points out, well, he, you know, in so many words, that this system is falling apart, and, you know, and that thinking has its issues in terms of trying to integrate into a burning house, as he put it. But I want to ask you this, and maybe put it this way, and it goes back to what you were talking about earlier in terms of the historical, those who saw things differently in terms of what is really in our best interest. And in the end of your article, you point to some more contemporary examples, all the hot spots right now, of things. And I got from what you were saying that there are lessons to be learned in places like Niger, this declared cookout on AFRICOM, Haiti, that's resisting and you know, trying to repel military intervention, and also Gaza.
Yes, I mean, there are phenomenal historical things that are happening as we speak. And we do ourselves a disservice if we don't see ourselves as a part of that. In Niger and in that entire region, you know, in the Sahel and other places, they have successfully booted the French out. And nobody ever thought that they would see that. You know, France was dug in. They thought that they had conducted psychological operations against Africans in West Africa to cause them to believe that Africa couldn't live without France. And here they came together, and they're the first ones to boot them out, and the United States too. And they're doing just fine. And in the same way, the United States is in a panic, and they keep talking about and saying that the resistance that's taking place in Haiti is as the result of gangs and terrorists and that kind of thing. No, you ask those people what they're doing, they say, we're engaging in revolution. We want to be free. We want to be independent. And finally, you know, I note Gaza, which is going beyond my wildest dreams. It wasn't so long ago that it was just dangerous to even speak a word against Zionism in public. But now you see the entire world seeing the contradictions of Zionism and its connections to imperialism and boldly standing against it and speaking against it, and to the point where I think that it's really on the ropes. And I think that, you know, as Dr. King understood early on, he saw the early signs of it. This empire, like all empires, eventually collapses. And he called it a burning house. It's on its way out. So the last thing for us to want to do is to try and get a stake in that and to try and become a part of it and to become, you know, okey-doke kinds of spokespeople for imperialism. And we got plenty of those functioning right now. We don't need any more. And so we want to join the world. We want to join the rest of the communities around the world that are trying to bring this down. That's where our community is.
Thank you. Some of PAGA's analysis, Pan-African Community in Action, is that we're a domestic colony within this, certainly. We've been stolen from our land, and indigenous people had the land stolen from. But what you said that makes me think of that is that, and this is what I liken it to, is that we also, and it's not, you know, it's particularly non-white people, but everybody, have to see ourselves as part of the global South, part of that global South resistance. But thank you so much for this analysis. We really appreciate it. Everybody has to check out this article, Black, Angry, and Proud of It, by Mark Fanter, is in the latest edition of Black Agenda Report. Thank you so much for being on Voices with Vision, Mark. We'll have you back soon.
Oh, no, thank you. I look forward to it.
You're listening to Voices with Vision, the show that's not for the politically faint of heart, on your Jazz and Justice station, WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
On last week's episode of Voice with Vision, we ended with opening the phone lines and taking input from callers about the U.S. elections. And we didn't have time to take more than, I think, maybe two, three callers. But the input was thought-provoking. Politicians and the liberal media cite voter apathy, you hear this all the time, as the cause of reduced voter turnout. But the reality is that their devotion to corporate interests over those of the people creates what they want to characterize as a lack of interest. Dr. Wilmer Leon, says public politics is the negotiating process between interested constituencies regarding the access to and distribution of limited resources and the resulting outcome or policy pertaining thereto. Dr. Wilmer Leon is a nationally broadcast talk radio host, an adjunct professor of political science, and host of the podcast Connecting the Dots with Dr. Wilmer Leon. Dr. Leon is also the author of Politics, Another Perspective. You can find much of his work on WilmerLeon.com. Brother Wilmer, welcome to Voices with Vision.
Brother Craig, as well as Brother Netfa, thank you both so much. It's truly an honor and a pleasure to be on the show.
Yeah, now you have this article in Black Agenda Report speaking of how the media is characterizing disinterest from voters as being apathy. What forms is the voter apathy propaganda taking now, and what do you think its impact will be?
Well, we've been hearing this since 2016 and Hillary Clinton's loss to Donald Trump. And after that election, there was a lot of discussion. She lost Michigan because Black people didn't turn out in Michigan. She lost Pennsylvania because Black people didn't. And there was this whole narrative about Hillary Clinton lost the election primarily because we did not turn out and vote for her. And what was overlooked was the fact that she ran a utterly, totally horrific campaign. She didn't go to Michigan. She went to Pennsylvania late, and she figured that if you roll Barack Obama out in the last 10 days of the election, then like ducks or lemmings, we would follow Barack Obama over the cliff, and we didn't do that. So now what we're seeing are articles about Joe Biden's losing the Black male vote. Donald Trump is gaining the black male vote. And all of these stories in mainstream press about the political dynamic, the demographics, how these demographics are shifting. And what's being lost in all of this is Joe Biden isn't telling us anything. He has no message other than democracy is being challenged and I'm not Donald Trump. Well, thank you, Captain Obvious. We know you're not Donald Trump. And what gets one of the things that I learned, probably as a freshman at Hampton in Intro to Political Science with Mr. Novell Dickinson, was people have a tendency to vote for things, not against things. And the Democrats aren't giving the community anything substantive to vote for. It's all of this hyperbole and hysteria and Trump derangement syndrome instead of addressing what are the true maladies and issues that are causing problems in America at its very core.
You mentioned Hillary Clinton. I wanted to ask you about that because Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump. Now, like you say, these early polls are showing that Joe Biden is losing support, will probably lose to Donald Trump, in part because of U.S. support for this genocidal war against Palestinians at the hands of the Zionist entity. And then also you have this bottomless expenditures on war in the Ukraine. What do you think are the prospects that the Democratic Party can like learn some lesson here and then maybe alter its hawkish imperialist projects in order to survive as a party that can win elections?
Well, I think it was Einstein. This quote is attributed to a number of people, but I think it was Einstein that said that engaging in the same behavior repeatedly and expecting a different result is insanity. And so the Democrats are insane because, once again, they're not offering anything. They're not offering substantive policy except some retreads of policies that Biden or initiatives that Biden promised in 2020 and never delivered on, such as increasing taxes on the wealth. He told us that in 2020, and now he didn't do it then. So what's the probability of him doing it now? Less than then, because if he gets elected, he won't be able to run again. So I have zero confidence that they're going to learn these lessons. And if they do, they'll learn the lessons after it's way too late, because I think this election is going to be a critical election in terms of the duopoly in this country. And there are going to be so many people that I think are disaffected, disenchanted, and they're going to be disassociated that they're going to throw up their hands in total disgust. Look at the number of the they call them the dual haters, those that are opposed to Trump and Biden. Look at to the what was the term they used? None of the above. I can't remember the exact term in Michigan and in Minnesota. Uncommitted. Michigan, Minnesota, Colorado. That uncommitted number is growing. And that, to me, it should be a clarion call to the Democrats. You aren't resonating with your base. And because they're no longer concerned about the base, they're concerned about the elite. They're concerned about that $100 million from AIPAC. They're concerned about Chase Bank and Lockheed Martin so that they can continue to send weapons to Ukraine and to Gaza. In anticipation, they're trying to start a fight with China. They're trying to extend this losing effort in Ukraine. Israel is hoping against hope. They can draw the United States into that Middle East conflict and bring Iran in as well, which I say to the Secretary of State and to Jake Sullivan, y'all better be careful what you pray for because you don't want it.
Right. Now, I was wondering, so if you could say something, there are those who would say, and I guess maybe I was one of them, but as I hear you talk, maybe that for the Democrats to do the things that constituents would want them to do, would also be for that class, that oligarchic class, would spell the beginning of the end for them. It would be like a political suicide, so to speak. And so I was going to ask you what you say to that. What do you say to that?
Well, there's a great piece in Real Clear Politics called The Canaries in America's Coal Mine. And the article's focus is that you've got Trump and you've got Biden, two old white men that are talking at each other, not talking to the American people, and neither of them are really proposing to their constituency the things that will address the real issues that are rotting this country from the inside out. And so, for example, they talk about life expectancy in the United States is on the decline. Suicide among white males between the ages of like 18 and 36 on the rise, jaw-dropping rates of obesity, rising truancy among students. There are studies that show the Survey on American Life says that that 48% of Americans say they have less than three close friends. So they're looking at things. The amount of depression and anxiety is on the rise in the United States. So these are the things that are eating away at Americans' sense of security. And they're committing suicide at historic rates, then obviously their perception of the American dream has changed and their confidence in the ability to achieve the American dream has changed. And so they're not offering anything as it relates to healthcare, as it relates to child daycare, the raising, getting to a living wage, the number of things that are actually going to improve the quality of life in this country for Americans. That money is being sent to pay salaries for workers in Ukraine. It's being sent to pay for retirement and pensions for Ukrainians when Americans don't have pensions. And folks, this is not my opinion. This is what the data says. These numbers are real. If they can afford to pay for Ukrainians, why can't they have pensions in this country?
And you have the hyperlinks to the documents to prove in your article.
Absolutely. Always got to provide the data. Because here's the thing, Brother Craig and Brother Neffa, I say this to folks all the time. I am not a political operative. I'm a political scientist. And I got to look at the data and talk about what the data shows me, the talking points be damned.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. One of the things that I wanted to, and I don't know if this is really that, we mentioned that movement that's advocating for the uncommitted. Mm-hmm. So they're actually advocating, it's taking traction in Michigan. And so there are those who've always been saying, if you don't vote for Democrat or Republican or something, you're shirking your responsibility, you know, particularly Black people. We not die for the vote and all this kind of stuff. This uncommitted movement is actually not suggesting people don't vote. It's actually suggesting people go and use the vote to cast a, you know, like a, make a statement. This sort of seems to rob the, you know, those who advocate the, you know, the responsibility thing of what they say. Because usually they sort of mean, most of the time they mean vote for Democrat. If you mean that, because there's nothing else, she's only two. Can you tell us more about the uncommitted movement and that traction, what's motivating, and what the implications of it? What do you think of it?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, to the discussion about too many of our ancestors died for the right to vote. Therefore, if we don't vote, then we're disrespecting our ancestors. Fannie Lou Hamer did not, Mrs. Hamer did That's not right. sacrifice what she sacrificed for us to vote in the context of a process.
That's right.
It was for us to have actually something to vote for. Folks get so caught up in the process. I went and I got a sticker on my shirt that said I voted. But what did you vote for? That's the first point. The second point is, one of the callers from last week, the first caller from last week was calling from Germany. And he talked about, well, if you don't vote for Trump or you don't vote for Biden, who are you going to vote for that can win? I don't know of any document that I've ever read relative to the vote that talks about winning. We are not a quote unquote winning democracy. We are a representative democracy. You're voting for someone to represent your interests. You're not picking, as you said, I think it was Netflix, as you said last week, this ain't a horse race. This is not a horse race that we're engaged in. And then there's also this Trump derangement syndrome that, you know, Trump is so crazy. He's so evil. And well, right now it's Joe Biden is back in the genocide. You know, right now it's Joe Biden that started that war in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin responded to the aggression by NATO. He didn't wake up on a Tuesday morning and say, you know what I think I'm gonna do today? I think I'm gonna go ahead and invade Ukraine. No, that's not what he did. So, and by the way, the lesser of two evils is still evil. So now, that's a very long way to get to your answer. I understand the uncommitted or non-committed vote was really started by angry Arab Americans in Michigan that said, under no circumstances are we going to vote for Joe Biden. That this is the man,
Genocide Joe,
leading Genocide Joe, that is leading the extermination of their people, our people, and under no circumstances can we vote for a person that does that. Now, the impact of this, one of the things going back to the data, is that by checking a box of uncommitted, that actually got registered and quantified. So you can see in Michigan, the power of that vote. It's right there in front of you. It's a data point. And so it's no longer ambiguous. It's no longer left up to the imagination of, I wonder how many people are. No, they told you very clearly. And when you look at us, I can't remember, Joe Biden might have won Michigan by 120,000 votes in 2020.
It's in your article. I don't remember.
I think you said 150. Okay.
I can't quote myself. Anyway, 100. So he won by 150,000 votes, and there were 100,000 uncommitted voters. Joe, the race is thinner, is closer today than it was 4 years ago. But the ironic thing is, still not getting the message. Still, because they're stuck on stupid. Still not getting the message. So this is a very, very, very powerful tool that could pave the way for some shifts in the dynamic.
Yeah, I got Craig, so go ahead. I know. We run out of time. You go first. I'll leave mine last.
Okay. Because you talked about a shift, and you also talked about how you don't think the Democratic Party is going to learn this lesson when you answered my last question. So here's another similar question where you see how the Republican Party, it's moved more to the right over the last several election cycles. Then you see that the Democratic Party seems to also have moved to the right, responding to the Republican Party. They've also moved more to the right. I don't know if you would agree with that. You have candidates like Bill Clinton, Barack Obama. Their presidencies seem like they were mimicking Ronald Reagan, you know.
Joe Biden.
So, yeah. And so do you see any signs that the Democratic Party is going to continue basically following the lead of the Republican Party and Donald Trump? Or should we expect to see a rise in the power of more progressive Democrats inside of the party?
I would love to see the power of more progressive Democrats. Some of those voices are there, but they're being drowned out by the likes of Gregory Meeks and the likes of Hakeem Jeffries. Who thinks Jim Clyburn? We know Joe, and Joe knows us. Look, what Jeffries and Meeks and Kamala Harris are backing in terms of the United States reinvasion of Haiti is going to be on par with what's already going on in Gaza. So when you've got people like Lloyd Austin going to Kenya with a check in his hand, trying to convince Bhutto, is that what's the name of the the president of Kenya?
Yeah, that's it. Okay. Bhutto, or is it Bhutto? Yeah.
Ruto. Trying to convince Ruto to violate his constitution and send black faces into Haiti. I wrote a piece called The Dangers of Minstrel Diplomacy. That's blackface on white folks' imperialism. Mm-hmm. And so that's where your Congressional Black Caucus is. That's where Linda Thomas Greenfield is. That's where the general down in AFRICOM, Langley.
Michael Langley. Can I get one question? Now, you wrote some very telling things about the union, revealing things about union politics regarding this. And so, you know, it just seemed like it's, it's some, what is it saying? They're playing fast and loose, United Auto Workers, with their endorsements and giving political mechanics. What about that? You know, kind of quickly, what does it say?
That was incredibly telling. The president, Fain, the president of the UAW, came out in January and said that the UAW endorses Joe Biden. And then either the same day or the next day, in another speech, he said, the UAW endorses Joe Biden, but the rank and file of the UAW are not gonna vote for Joe Biden. So that shows you right there the dichotomy between the rank and file and leadership or the elite. You know, Fain has a well-paying job that voting, that endorsing Joe Biden helped to, I guess, solidify his tenure as head of the UAW. Those folks are, and what did Fain say? They're concerned about their paychecks. Mm-hmm. That's what he said. They're concerned about their paychecks.
And he still gave him an endorsement, despite that wasn't where they're going. But look, thank you, Dr. Wilmer Leon, for being on Voice with Vision, broadcast talk show host, adjunct professor of political science, and also host of Connecting the Dots, which is what we did here with Dr. Wilmer Leon. Check out WilmerLeon.com, WilmerLeon.com. Thank you so much for being on Voice with Vision, and you'll be back soon. We're going to ask you back.
Anytime. That's right. Thank you, brothers.
That's it for today's show. Thank you for listening. Remember to tune in to Voice with Vision every Tuesday from 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and follow and like Voices with Vision on Facebook.
And you can follow me, Netfa, on X, used to be known as Twitter. That's Netfa Free. That's N-E-T-F-A, free. Don't forget, you can also listen and subscribe to Voices with Vision as a podcast on Google Podcasts or iTunes or Player FM. Just search for Voices with Vision, WPFW. Keep it locked right here for Crossroads with Roach Brown and Kichi Taifa. Make an effort to stay politically educated, organized, and committed to the fight for the liberation of your people. or
fall back.
It goes F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people.
Come on.
F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your freedom. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your freedom. L-I-B-R-B-G, we live. F-R-E, yeah, D-I-E. We lace music with code, just something to bring us closer. Kick troop, the young black youth like we supposed to. No swine in our rovers or Louis Vuitton holsters. We in the trench with young 50 cents and street soldiers. The ones they ain't lock up and send the foreign waters to fight for something they ain't got in their own borders. It's us, the free unit, they ain't holding us back. We score the soundtrack to this movement, y'all just rap. Brat, black on black and clap about that. State trooper shot, Miss Assembly's boy in the back. Miss Rogers boy in the back. While we ain't firing back, the boys is gone and they ain't coming back. We gotta go back, San Kofa right and exact. It's the red, green, and the black. It go F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people. Come on. F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your freedom. Fall back.
Born of Haitian descent, Jerry Paris, WPFW's general manager, is moving on to retirement. On April 14th, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m., we will celebrate his departure at the VIP Room, 6201 3rd Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., with island flair, steel drums, a DJ, and food from the islands. That's April 14th from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m. For more information and tickets, call 202-368-4081 or visit Eventbrite and search for Jerry Paris Retirement. Seating is limited.
Hello, WPFW. Festival season is here, which means good music, good food, and good people. The 8th annual Words, Beats, and Life Festival kicks the season off with events from April 1st through 7th in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Featured artists include a special evening with Saul Williams, April 5th at Woolly Mammoth Theater, Sunken Cages, Dragon Child, and Faraway Ghost at Millennium Stage, April 4th, Diggable Planets, Sun Ra Orchestra, and more at the Jazz and Blossoms Park Jam, April 7th, plus Poetry Slams, a hip-hop education conference, and free dance workshops all week. To learn more about all the events, visit wblinc.org/WBLFest.
Greetings, family. The WPFW Programmers Association, in harmony with station management, presents WPFW Live, a series of events over the next 6 months in partnership with some of your favorite local venues. The goal is to re-engage the community through a remembering of the valued relationships forged, all pointing to a reimagination of our future. Our first WPFW Live event will be held Wednesday, April 3rd, 5 to 9 p.m. at 18th Street Lounge, 1230 9th Street Northwest. Meet some of your favorite local programmers, enjoy great music, and partake in good spirits. Music by DJ Rasan, Music Relief Radio, Kamal Harris, Beats, Bars, and Bangers, and featuring DJ Divine Soulful House Sessions. Food by Chef Jarobi of Flavorful Influences. Tickets are $20 and available at Eventbrite by searching WPFW Live. For details, call 202-618-2110. WPFW, changing the world one live event at a time.
WPFW must move by December 2024 and will be hosting a series of events and presenting special programming to raise the funds necessary for our new home. We kick off these efforts Saturday through Sunday, April 6th and 7th, with Jazz is the Teacher, Funk is the Preacher, 2 days of programming dedicated to the jazz and funk idioms. From the searing riffs of the J.B. Horns to Les McCann's soulful piano comping, to the Art Ensemble of Chicago's funk-drenched composition, Theme de Yo-Yo, jazz and funk have always been intertwined. We're hoping that the music inspires you to support this effort by visiting WPFWFM.org to make a tax-deductible secure donation to our relocation fund. That's Jazz is the Teacher, Funk is the Preacher, Saturday and Sunday, April 6th and 7th, from midnight to midnight. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time. Thank you.